Where is Nadia, the mystery surrounding the whereabouts of one member?
Uma das jovens presas do grupo
Nadia Tolokonikova, la jeune femme
membre du groupe Pussy Riot. Pussy Riot grubu Nadia Tolokonikova, açlık grevine başladı.
Tolokonikova в Саранске или в Челябинске стало понятно, что...
Stealthy trains with secret destinations. A clandestine network of transit prisons where inmates can languish for weeks on end. Prisoners held in subhuman conditions while kept incommunicado from relatives and lawyers. These are just some of the features of a process known in Russian as etapirovanie, the shadowy process by which prison inmates are transferred on specially equipped trains from one penal facility to another. This gulag-era institution was in the spotlight in recent weeks due to the prison train odyssey of jailed Pussy Riot member Nadezhda Tolokonikova, who was out of sight but very much in the headlines for 3 weeks as she moved from one prison colony to another as her family and supporters puzzled over her whereabouts. Just months ago, Tolokonikova drew attention to conditions in Russia's prisons with a hunger strike and an open letter that sparked international headlines. And without even saying a word, she seems to have done it again. Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. With me in the studio here in Prague is special guest Mirhat Sharapjan, a journalist in RFERL's central newsroom who was a Soviet-era political prisoner. Welcome, Mirhat.
Hi, I'm very happy to be here.
Happy to have you. And joining us on the Skype line from London is co-host Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology journal NZ. Welcome back from your travels, Kirill.
I'm glad to be here again.
We're glad to have you and glad to see you. And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of the must-read Sean's Russia blog. Welcome, Sean.
Hello.
Mirhat, let's start with you, since you have more perspective on this kind of thing than the rest of us. During your time as a political prisoner in the USSR, you spoke to many inmates who endured this procedure. Can you just walk us through it? What happens to an inmate during the etapirovanie process? What happens?
Well, we just call it etap. Beitina etap, to go to etap. Well, the thing is that I was lucky enough. I was not in a huge, long etaps, but I am aware what it is because there were some short distances I covered in that kind of Stolypinsky vagoni or vagonzak.
And that's interesting, the Stolypinsky vagon. I was wondering if that came from the Stolypin time.
I have no idea why they call it. The thing is that everything begins with the preparations of what I call the worst part of any then Soviet convict during his or her term. The worst thing is etap. First of all, you have to get ready. You have to have enough sukhari, the dried bread, and most importantly, was necessary to have as much as possible plastic bags, polyethylene pakety, which was a shortage at that time. But we had to have them because during etap, the guards allow you only twice to go to toilet, but when you want to go to toilet and there is no time for it, which is usually in the morning and then in the night before going to bed.
Which is when you usually have to go to the toilet.
Yeah, and then you have to use a plastic bag and then with a rubber seal it and throw it away next time when you're able to get out from the cage. And the train itself is a cage. Cage is, it's like, you just imagine if you ever seen the Soviet trains inside this placard coupe,
right.
So-called. It's like the same, but with bars, very thick.
And unlike a placard coupe, which has 4 to 6 people in it.
There might be about 20 or more
20
in
or
one
more
place
in
sitting, and this is a mess. The smell... the sweat, the all other smells you can imagine, and plus the smell, I still remember, the smell of the burned coal all the time there. It's heavy and it doesn't go anywhere. So this is a nightmare to you to go there. Sometimes it takes long distances. I help many of my friends to get ready for a etap. And I know what it is. And they sometimes to go, let's say, from Omsk to somewhere in Irkutsk, people can go move there for about half a year, because every time the train, the special train or special train car, which is usually attached to some other trains, has to go almost secretly. Nobody's supposed to see it. And Wagonzak, the automobile which carries the convicts or suspects, has to come very close, just next to the Stolypinsky wagon, Wagonzak, very close so that nobody could see it. And when an inmate steps out of the car and steps on the Stolypinsky wagon, nobody sees him because it's so close to these two vehicles are very close to each other. It's completely separate, parallel life. Ordinary people are not supposed to see it. It's a secret, and always was a secret. It's Stalin's era. And you have to stay in transit prisons or every prison or detention center in Siberia or Kazakhstan, which was a huge part of Gulag system, has transit jails or just the regular detention centers, which had or still has transit cells for those who are on transit. And they are just there sometimes waiting for the next train for 1, 2, or 3 months. Because, well, it's understandable. Russia or the Soviet Union then was huge, and Russia is now huge. And, you know, to save money, the groups have to get accumulated in one prison or one transit.
And so there's an alternative train schedule almost going on with these kind of secret transit prisons
because,
all over the
because
country.
Because the penal colonies had factories in them, huge factories, and all the majority, the major part of all the convicts were used at those factories for almost free labor. And all those factories had plans, and I don't know about now, but then the plan is supposed to be fulfilled, and all the outputs have to be done on time, and every factory had special requests. We need, let's say, this quarter of the year, we need like 60 people to be brought to our plant or our penal colony. So they're sent from different parts of the Soviet Union, from Uzbekistan, from Latvia, let's say, from anywhere. And all these people go in different ways. And while they go there to different parts, there are some distribution centers, you know, and then it takes a lot of time. And always it was a rule then and it's a rule now. Nobody's informed about it. Nobody knows where you are. The only system which knows about everyone on etap is a criminal system. The system...
So the federal penal...
The people like Variv Zakonia or big criminal authorities who are on etap, they knew beforehand where they're going and how they're going, and everything was done to take care of them and get them ready for that so that they couldn't suffer as much as others.
Right. So what Nadezhda Tolokonikova just went through is, in fact, not that unusual. Thousands of prisoners go through this and are going through this as we speak. Kirill, it's my understanding that largely this procedure hasn't changed since Soviet times. Is this just inertia, or is there a reason why the authorities would want to keep such a procedure intact?
I think you already used the key word for all this situation, Stolypinsky wagon. Actually, it was named by Interior Minister Pyotr Arkadyevich Stolypin in the end of 1910s during the suppression of the First Russian Revolution. And the invention, of course, he was not an engineer and so on, but it was named by him because
he wasn't a tailor either, but there were Stolypinsky Golstiki as well.
Absolutely. But now what's interesting is not the history of the very term, but this term is still in use in the modern Russian prison system. and in common language. That symbolized the archaic state of Russian penal and prison system now. I think it's a deliberately archaic system. It's very interesting that October Revolution, which destroyed everything or almost everything in old Russian Empire, didn't touch the prison system. And the modern prison system, which is a legacy from the, Soviet times, and Soviet prison system was the legacy of, Imperial Russia. In some sense, they tried to keep this old system, but to make it harsher, to make it, more unhuman, and so on during Gulag times. But the very logic, the very foundation, the very attitude of the authorities and even maybe the society to the system is still the same. So I'd like to call it not, just Stolypinsky wagon, but it's all this prison or penal system, it's Stolypinsky system, Stolypinsky system or Stolypin system. And of course, 100 years ago, maybe 110, 12 to 20 years ago, it was not such harsh as now. The system was the same, but, it was, we can say, more human about prisons and so on, but in some sense more human. I just returned from Krasnoyarsk, and there is a museum. It's very interesting. It's a steamboat, Svetoy Nikolai, Saint Nicholas, with a very old one, it was built in the end of 19th century, and in the 1890s, that was the only one steamboat on Yenisei River. And there is just one cabin in the steamboat. And once this cabin was occupied by future Nicholas II, who was traveling as a prince, crown prince in Siberia and then going to Japan. And several years later, this cabin was occupied by Vladimir Lenin, who was sent to Shushinskaya during this time. So at that time, prisoner, especially political prisoner, could enjoy, such treatment like, crown prince and so on. But of course, that was the exception. I'm not speaking that Russian pre-revolutionary system was, romantically, good and so on. No. But it's interesting how time changed.
Mm-hmm. No, and thanks to, because a lot of people, a lot of Russians didn't really know the ins and outs of this. And now, thanks to Telekonikova and her fame, we know about this, and a lot of people that wouldn't have otherwise known about this. Along these lines, the author and opposition activist Dmitry Bykov wrote recently on his blog that Telekonikova has become, quote, the world's most famous Russian other than the president, unquote, adding that, quote, she has rapidly and decisively forced the authorities to discredit themselves. Sean, the whole Telekonikova odyssey has indeed brought something thousands of prisoners have endured for decades into the public spotlight. She did something similar with her hunger strike and open letter back in September, which generated unexpected sympathy and respect. On the other hand, things like this tend to make the headlines for a few weeks and then they fade from public view. Do you see any long-term impact from this in changing this centuries-old practice?
Well, the fact that it's centuries old and you have periodic points in it in the prison system's history where a lot of light is shown on it, and not much seems to have changed. It's really hard to say what the long term impact of this. I mean, she has shed more light on the Russian prison system than anyone has in a number of years. And the question is, if she gets out of prison in March, what she will do with herself, if she will continue to make this a cause and use her celebrity and use her fame as an international activist to shine more light on it. But I think the larger problem is that, she's just an individual. And the prison rights movement in Russia is incredibly small. There's only a handful of organizations that deal with infractions in the treatment of prisoners. But her hunger strike, though, and now her disappearance, while shining a lot of light on the Russian prison system, this hasn't necessarily translated into any beginnings of a larger social movement, that's fighting for prisoner rights. I mean, the main problem is that, like in most societies, prisoners remain incredibly marginal figures, and the majority of populations feel that whatever treatment they get, they deserve.
Well, along these lines, I mean, speaking to RFRL this week, Tolokonikova's husband, Pyotr Verzilov, called her long transfer an act of revenge. Let's listen to Pyotr Verzilov speaking to RFRL this week.
We think that this super long prison transfer, which is connected to, which went together with the complete isolation of Nadia, is basically a sort of punishment that has been used by the Russian prison system in order to punish Nadezhda for the big attention that her letters have brought to the human rights abuses inside the prison system.
Merkel, what about that? Was it common to use the ATAP process as punishment, or was it just a necessary part of moving prisoners
well,
around?
Well, I think this is a punishment because she might be moved. She was in Mordovia,
yeah,
which is not a picnic place too, but she might be sent to Chuvashia, as it was just next door. Republic, Russian Republic, bordering with Mordovia. She might be sent to Tatarstan, which also has prisons, you know. But they have chosen Krasnoyarsky Krai, like, you know, thousands of kilometers.
Right.
Of course, it is common, it would be common, I would say, if she was just sentenced and then was sent immediately to some place far away. And it can be explained by necessity, by, let's say, some factory producing something needs some more people. That's why this portion of the convicts was sent there and not here. But in this situation, I think it's a punishment because they have chosen to send her far away and spend more than 3 weeks, almost a month, in transit jails, in those wagonzaks, Stalupin train cars and stuff. This is harsh. I just couldn't imagine a young lady in this situation.
Right.
I saw was a young man, crazy enough and tough enough, and we could stand it when we were young, and, you know, we were men anyway.
Right.
And we could speak to the guards and find some common, you know, some guards were friendly, some not, but we always were, you know, joking and looking forward. But this is, we're talking about a lady. To send a lady like
a young
this.
Woman in her early 20s.
And then as if there are no other people in Krasnoyarsk or Irkutsk to serve their prison terms work at the factories in the penal system there in Krasnoyarsk, they have chosen her to send from Mordovia. That was, for me, clear.
Now, their stated reason for this is that she's propisand in Norilsk.
Her official registration as a permanent resident is in Norilsk, which I don't buy because this is a good, very KGB way. Why didn't they send there
to start with?
You know, and the other thing is, in the former Soviet Union, whoever you are, a Georgian or a Kazakh or an Uzbek, if you committed crime in Moscow or St. Petersburg, you usually don't go far away from the place you are registered, but the place you committed crime. In some cases, when it was necessity, as I said before, like industrial necessities, the new plants being opened or built, you know, they were sent far away. But in this case, it's...
First of all, it's different times. The prison system and the production that comes out of the prison system isn't as important a part of the economy as it was in the Soviet times. So I doubt there was an economic reason.
Yeah.
They went with the very very official reason. Kirill, Sean, what do you think? Was this revenge, or and if so, how is it playing?
I think, of course, it's obvious that is a revenge, of course. But the situation shows very interesting things about the state of Russian authorities and so on. Because Tolokonikova, she's young, she's, you know, she's a lady and so on, but she is winning now battle after battle in, you know, in this public image field.
So you agree with Bykov?
Yes. So I don't like to agree with Bykov.
I was provoking you.
In any case, but I have to say yes. She's winning. Yeah, and Russian authorities, regime, their regime, yes, is losing one battle after another. but it doesn't interest you know, the prison authorities. It's very interesting that, you know, we can speak about Russian state as a something, you know, as a whole body. There are some, you know, state interests. So there are some, you know, interests of Putin and his, you know, circle and so on. And the prison system has its own interests. And this revenge is in the interests of this particular this particular system, this particular, you know, militia and so on, generals and colonels and so on. This is not all this, you know, revenge story is not in the interest of, you know, public image of Putin himself and so on. This is it's unnecessary, you know, cruelty.
What you're saying is the prison authorities were the initiators of this, not the Kremlin.
Yes, I am absolutely sure that that we, you know, can say that you know, Russian state or Russian authorities are divided in this question. No, they are not divided, because we can speak about Russian state as a whole thing. Yeah.
Mm. Sean, what do you think? Now, in your comments earlier, you were saying that, you know, despite Telekonikova's fame, this issue isn't really getting much traction, but yet she does seem to be winning the PR war with them. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, she clearly is winning the PR war. I mean, her hunger strike, her letter and her hunger strike got, you know, massive attention within Russia and outside of Russia. I mean, there's, you know, she's definitely winning the PR war. There's no question about that. And it's clear to me that this transfer was definitely a punishment against what she did. It's an attempt to break her further. But the question is okay, so they're winning the Russian government has lost a lot of PR wars, but still, as their image degenerates, the question is, how does this translate into something beyond just PR? And that's the big question that I have. And you know, who knows what will happen? I mean, I think that, you know, if I have any guess on the character of Telekonikova, is that she's going to certainly speak up and press on. I don't think they'll be able to successfully silence her in any way.
Well, what was interesting about this, as I said in my intro, she was out of sight. We didn't hear from her, but she stayed in the headlines.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we haven't really heard from her yet. I know Pyotr Vasilyev is supposed to see her today in Krasnoyarsk, if I'm not mistaken, and will be speaking publicly by the time this podcast hits the air. He will already have done so, I'm sure. But we can begin to speak of this Telekonikova phenomenon. She's due to get out in March. I haven't seen any indication that she's going to be kept in beyond that. The same with Alokhin. I think I right now expect them both to walk free in March, which is only 4 months away. What next? What next? Anybody? Kirill. Or Sean.
Sean, yeah. I think that's a really good question, and hopefully, I mean, the question is, what will happen once others get a hold of her, if that's even possible? And here I'm not speaking of the Russian government. I'm speaking of the kind of industry of celebrity activism that we see not only on a national but also an international level. I mean, she's going to be tempted with many, many things to kind of come to the West, to, you know, tour around and give talks. And the question is, will this dilute her ability to possibly spark a wider concern, first about, you know, general political activism and dissent in Russia? But I think she really could be the Solzhenitsyn of modern Russia, in her experience and her ability to communicate that experience really clearly and really in a incredibly humane way. And I think that this is what her letter was incredibly powerful, because not only did it point to her own individual experience, but she was able to communicate that experience in a broader sense to really give voice to those many prisoners who don't have a voice.
Yeah, I mean, Mirkat, being somebody in this position does give you some status with Russians. We've spoken about this in the podcast in the past. Looking at what Telekonikova has been through, what she was imprisoned for to begin with, what has happened since, what kind of status do you see that giving her in the broader society? Because she is Russia's most famous political prisoner right now.
Oh, yes, he. I'm sure she will be. For many in Russia, especially in big cities, for young people, she might become a symbol of something very important. One more thing: many people whose relatives are in jail respect her already,
mm-hmm.
and there are many mm-hmm. in Russia, or those who used to be in jail. If you look, every third or fourth family in Siberia had somebody in the past or has now in jail for different reasons. It doesn't matter. Not all of them were like political prisoners or something, but still they are adoring her.
Mm.
They love what she's doing. And not only in Russia, actually. We know that her name today, even in some parts of Kazakhstan or in Ukraine, they know her.
I saw graffiti in an underpass in Tbilisi, you know, in support of her, which is which
there was also the Soviets still genetically, you know, I know all the former Soviet nations remember what Gulag was and how many people just served their terms for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And some generations, some representatives of those of that generation are still there. That is a part of the society which is going to respect her.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the society. And second part is young people who know what freedom is, who know what human rights is, who travel abroad and know they also, this is her public there.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm afraid that there are also many people in Russia who still wouldn't be able to forgive her, mm-hmm. quote and unquote, what she did in a sacred place
right.
with this huge impact and influence and growing authority of Orthodox Church there in Russia,
yeah.
In remote places, in some other places of Russia still. So I don't know what's going to happen. She's going to be tempted with many ideas, as Sean said, but... I think she. What I think about her, I adore her myself. I think she is a strong lady, and from what I heard about her, and I'm continuing looking what she's doing. I think she's a strong lady, and she will continue her fight against a беспредел in Russia. Hopefully,
no. It has truly been remarkable, the transformation of her public image. Because if you think back to the incident at the Christ the Savior Cathedral, and the reactions of many people, even those who are supporters, these spoiled rich Moscow kids, defaming a sacred place, and now as a result of her experience, as a result of, again, to use this overused phrase from Akhmatova, but the biography the authorities have created for her, she has turned into this very authoritative figure. Kirill, do you see this continuing?
Yes, but two remarks in advance when we speak about her future. First of all, there are two young ladies, not just Tolokonnikova, but
of course.
And that's very important because both of them, of course, Tolokonnikova, much more glamorized, by media and so on. But they are, both of them, they're very clever. They're very good fighters, and they don't use any compromises and so on. So we can speak about not their common future, because they are two different people and so on. But anyway, there are two very important figures are upcoming for Russian political and social scene. That's my first remark. The second one, of course, we can't, speak about, Tolokonnikova Alekhina future in March or in April next year, because we don't know what will happen there. So it's all or nearly all about the future context, political and social and ideological, even ideological context of next spring. Because there are several, I agree with Mirkha, there are several options for both of them. Don't forget that Pussy Riot was feminist punk band. Feminist.
Mm-hmm.
And all this, glamorization of Tolokonnikova image and so on is strongly against, any feminist beliefs. So that will be, for her personally, a very serious choice. If she will go on with, you know, as a glamour person of Russian opposition, you know, moving between, you know, live roundtable on Dosh TV and interview for Snop online, yeah? Or she will become not a, you know, so-called straight political fighter just against Putin regime and so on. But I think her proper place is in a future new, absolutely new social and political movement, which is not just against, you know, particular one Putin or something like this. This future political movement, young and ideologically, you know, funded with the new ideas and so on, must be against, you know, so-called old archaic Russia. Including all this issue about feminism, church, and so on. That will be, for me, of course, I'm not, you know, giving her advice, so I'm not in the position to give advice for such, you know, a person. But for as far as I understand, that will be the best option for her. Mm. Because if she will become one of the figures on this, you know, traditional Russian opposition scene, that will be a great failure.
Mm. Yeah, I think I would tend to agree with you on that. And I mean, and of course, we should not forget Alyokhina, but the reason we're focusing on Tolokonikova is because she was, in fact, in the news in recent weeks. But come March, the two of them are going to walk out of prison, barring unforeseen circumstances, and they're going to do so with a new status that they didn't have before they went into prison. Sean, any last thoughts before we move on to the next sections?
No, I don't have.
You're really anxious. Sean is really anxious to get to the next section. In a few moments, we're going to shift gears and look at one of the strangest things ever to happen on Red Square. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. With me in the studio here in Prague is special guest Mirkat Sharapjan, a journalist in RFRL's central newsroom who was a Soviet-era political prisoner. Also joining us on the Skype line from London is co-host Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology journal NZ. And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of the Must Read Sean's blog. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
We are moving toward a police state. We see the government cutting funding for the Academy of Sciences and cultural institutions, but at the same time pumping more money into law enforcement and security agencies, increasing their personnel and salaries. That is a clear movement toward a police state, and the people are allowing it to happen. What we have here is political indifference.
Who was that? That was Pyotr Pavlensky, and we're going to find out a little bit about who he is now. From military parades to political demonstrations to public executions to the mummified corpse of Vladimir Lenin, Red Square has been the scene of many things, from the grandiose to the grotesque. But this week, it may have witnessed its most poignant spectacle when artist Pyotr Pavlensky entered the square, stripped naked, and nailed his scrotum to the cobblestones. Pavlensky has a history of self-abusive art. He has sewn his lips together to show solidarity with jailed Pussy Riot members, and he has wrapped himself in barbed wire outside the Russian government building. He timed his latest action to fall on the Police Day holiday, calling it a protest against what he called Russia's police state. In a statement, Pavlensky said the performance can be seen as a metaphor for the apathy, political indifference, and fatalism of contemporary Russian society. As the government turns the country into one big prison, stealing from the people and using the money to grow and enrich the police apparatus and other repressive structures, society is allowing this and forgetting its numerical advantage, is bringing the triumph of the police state closer by its inaction. Writing on his Facebook page, theater director Kirill Serebrennikov called the performance a powerful gesture of absolute despair. The author and journalist Masha Gessen wrote in the New York Times that the sight of a naked man sitting on the ground on a cold, drizzly day, his scrotum pierced by a giant nail, scarred people on both sides of the political spectrum. Sean, I know you have something to say about this because you were planning on writing about it. I haven't had a chance to read what you've written.
No, I didn't
you
have. It.
But what do you make? Give us a little preview. What do you make of this?
You know what? At first, I probably, like a lot of people, when I heard about this story, I ridiculed it just because it's so outlandish. And then I started to think about it and start taking it seriously. And I was kind of captivated by the statement that he's making, this idea of and the act being called fixation, of this man nailed to the pavement, kind of fixating on his genitals. And this as a symbol of the apathy of Russian society toward the political situation. But what really interests me is the use Pavlinsky's use of his body.
Mm-hmm.
And bodies are incredibly important to protest in general. I mean, when you have a mass demonstration, it is filled with bodies. Bodies are counted. How many bodies are present determines a protest's success or failure. And we also have other protests that are using the body. Tolikonikova's hunger strike is the use of her body to protest against, you know, her treatment within prison. I've also looked up cases of self-immolation that have happened in Russia and in recent years, these kind of desperate acts of protest for whatever reason. Again, a person using their body, but also pain to really communicate some kind of protest or some kind of symbolism of their treatment, whatever that treatment may be. And so I was definitely kind of captivated by, you know, first his other acts that Pavlinsky has used, the sewing of his lips to protest Pussy Riot's conviction, wrapping himself in barbed wire nude to protest the anti-gay legislation in St. Petersburg, and now driving a nail through his scrotum and the shock of that scene, really his body being used as a means to speak. And I found that incredibly powerful when I started to think about it seriously.
I don't know what he's gonna do next.
They actually have charged him with hooliganism today. Yes. So he's looking at a possible 5-year sentence.
He was charged with hooliganism, and you have to wonder if they're gonna try to put him away a la Pussy Riot. Kirill, what's your take on this? What did you make of it?
I agree with Sean and Masha Gessen. That is a very powerful symbolic and artistic and political gesture. And some part of Russian opposition, you know, milieu, consider this as just a funny and so on. He's a little bit crazy. No, he's not crazy. I'm not, of course, comparing Pavlinsky to Jan Palach, who, you know, immolated himself in Prague in 1969.
Yes.
No, that was the protest not just against the Soviet invasion, but against the inertia of Czechoslovak society.
Mm-hmm.
In this situation, and that is a field of where you can compare, you know, Pavlinsky to him, because it's not a gesture against the, you know, authorities. It's a gesture against the inertia. And it's a very interesting and, you know, right position, because a lot of people who are fighting against, you know, Putin's regime and so on, some of them, you know, some of them just celebrities, some of them, you know, just absolutely unknown and obscure anyway, but there are a lot of people who do this job without, you know, big success and so on. Anyway, they're doing this job. And he tried to show the society that its inertia is, you know, not just dangerous, of course. It's just disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the sort of savage nature of this artistic gesture that is a symbol of, you know, this disgusting nature of the public's inertia. So I can connect this and his previous performances to the struggle against Putin regime and so on, because he's an artist. He's not, you know, a political artist.
Yeah.
He's trying to transforming the society, and that is a very good task for contemporary art.
Yeah, no, I mean, I have to admit, when I first heard of this, I was like, what? And I was kind of, quite frankly, grossed out by it. And I never actually brought myself around to actually watching the video until I was preparing this podcast. And a couple of things jumped out at me, and we're just really telling. The police had no idea what to do. That was the first thing. The police just had no idea what to do. This one police officer walked up to him. You have this naked guy sitting on Red Square with his private parts nailed to the cobblestones, and the cop says, "Stavaju vizhaimi." get up, guy.
No, the respected one.
Respectable gentleman. Or whatever. Yeah. And then, after a while, other police came. They covered him in a blanket, and Masha pointed this out in her New York Times blog. It made him look like Gandhi, when they covered him in a blanket. It took forever they had to get an ambulance and remove him from the cobblestone.
He looks like Gandhi. He's very thin, and his features are very he can be taken for an Indian guy. Yeah.
How did you react to this, Americana? I went from being grossed out to being just powerfully impacted by it.
I respected what he did, but I'm afraid the majority of Russian society didn't get it. I'm afraid this kind of protest probably would work somewhere in Netherlands or, some other place.
The irony there is there'd be no reason to do such
a
thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm just... In Moscow, of course, there is a tiny percentage of population, I believe, who got this message. But the majority would consider him a person who needs a psychiatrist. That's, unfortunately, what I see here. I understand what he was trying to do, and I'm on the side of this minority in Moscow who got the message.
Mm-hmm.
But and probably some more young people. I haven't been in Moscow for many years. I am talking from the point of view of a man who used to be a Soviet person, mm-hmm. Soviet citizen. But I have friends there, and I just continue watching what's going on there in my former country, mm-hmm. which is, Kazakhstan, of course, but still a part of the Soviet Union. And I think the majority of the Russian society didn't get it.
Mm. So on one hand, we have this, what Kirill called a powerful artistic gesture. But Mirkut, I think you're right that most people aren't going to get this. How useful are these artistic gestures, no matter how powerful, in provoking change? Either Sean or Kirill.
I think, and this could be, of course, to my own personal taste, but I think these kinds of symbols are incredibly powerful because, as Pavlinsky wanted to show, it is a gesture of powerlessness. But it's very interesting, too, the fact that – and Masha Gessen pointed this out and I think was a really interesting comment in her New York Times post about it. It really changes the way the state has to interact with the so-called protester. It removes – and she points out, the way police deal with protests – is through beating, through throwing people on the pavement and arresting them, really using physical force to deal with activists or protesters. But these acts, the Pavlinsky's act, the hunger strike, and even self-immolation and other acts where people inflict bodily harm to make a gesture, whether it's symbolic or an actual political gesture like a hunger strike, it changes the state's relationship to the protester. The state is turned into a position where it has to care for that person.
They had to be gentle with him.
And I think this is it reveals the power of first the individual and people in general. And this is one of the things that Pavlinsky said in his statement, that society has forgotten its numerical advantage mm-hmm. over the state.
Yeah, that may be the operative phrase of his statement, actually.
Yeah, and I think that through the use of one's body, and as I said, bodies are integral to protest, he changed the power calculation of the state – his relationship with the individual or with society. And I think that symbolism is incredibly powerful too.
Mm. Kirill, what would you say? Would you agree?
Yes. I wonder if contemporary artists, even, connected to political activism must be, extremely popular in any society. It's a very special area, very, full of reflections, considerations, explanations, interpretations, and so on. It's a highbrow, okay, it's a highbrow intellectual, area. But this area produces meanings for the whole society, words, ideas, so that's very important to work in this particular part of the society.
But what about if, as Mercat said, most people just don't get it and they think this guy's just nuts?
It's not, a sort of a direct action for which audience must be the whole society or the most part of the society. This is the task of such gestures or such, performances and so on, is quite close circle of, the political activists, intelligentsia, intellectuals, and so on. But they, in their turn, must send another message, more simple, more readable, and so on, to the outer society. It's not, aimed to reach the whole Russian society. Mm-hmm. It's just to push, to press these, intellectuals and so on, to rethink something, uh-huh, and then to send a message to the, outer world in Russia.
Well, one has to wonder where this goes now, because as Sean correctly pointed out, he's been charged with hooliganism and he actually faces a, semi-lengthy, potential five-year prison term. Are they going to put him on trial? Because all that would do was to keep reminding people of this and keep this message going. What do you think?
I think if he said something like, Jesus, take care of Putin, then he would probably end up as a Tolokonnikov. Since he didn't say anything against personal, no personal accusations, nothing, I think he will get away. He'll get some
administrative offense or something.
Yeah. Some
because, but they have charged him, and you have to wonder: are they going to now? Are we going to have the Pavlensky trial? Is this going to be the next big trial? And if so, what kind of a spectacle is that going to be? Because remember, as we went through the Pussy Riot trial, we kept seeing that video of them in the Christ the Savior Cathedral over and over and over again. Well, damn! I mean, if they put this guy on trial, guess what video we're going to have to keep looking at over and over and over again? What impact that is going to have in the broader society. Sean, any final thoughts before we wrap up on this? Because I know you're writing about this.
Yeah, I think if they do put him on trial, and I seriously hope that they don't, they will translate the message for him.
Exactly.
Just like they translated the message of Pussy Riot better than Pussy Riot did.
Yeah.
Over the repeated use of the video, the court case, the attention from the media, and I agree with Kirill, his message was targeted toward a particular audience. I don't think it was targeted toward society as a whole. But if they do proceed if the state proceeds with a court case, then that society will only grow. Will they actually get the act itself? Maybe not, but they'll certainly get its translation into other types of mediums and other types of words.
Well, one has to wonder, they've been stepping in it so much that I wouldn't be that surprised if they went ahead and put him on trial and stepped in it again. And that, unfortunately, is all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. With me in the studio here in Prague has been special guest Mirkat Sharapjan, a journalist in RFERL's central newsroom who is a Soviet-era political prisoner. And joining us on the Skype line from London has been co-host Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology journal NZ. And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of the must-read Sean's Russia blog. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion, as always.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our superhuman producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.